From KCRW, this is DNA, Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. The best view of a stage is typically front of house, not for this photographer.
What is happening behind the scene, what the people don't see behind the decoration, it's all people working on a very tight schedule together and everything is organized and planned.
Hear from Klaus Fram later in the show. And during the week of Passover, we'll hear about the exodus of Bauhaus-inspired architects and their impact on the Holy Land. First up, though, it was Easter Sunday in Paris, and this year Catholics did not celebrate the holiest of days at Notre Dame. But if congregants and tourists deeply miss the iconic church, architects are already dreaming up new versions of it. Barely had the ashes cooled, and the French government promised to rebuild by 2024. That's the year Paris hosts the Olympic Games. And they announced an international design competition. Well, this took some French architecture experts by surprise.
I was stunned because I found it extremely early in the process. The damage was not yet assessed. My concern is probably a premature and rather demagogic announcement.
Hear from architecture historian Jean-Louis Cohen coming up. Let's now get a few more details from the Consul General of France in Los Angeles, Christophe Lemoine.
It's the moment of assessment of the building. The fire has been controlled and, you know, the structure is still there, but the structure has suffered from water, from melted lead. So there is an all, you know, there are architectural assessment and technical assessment that should be done. So then there will be another time for opening this international competition, which is, I think, very excited for. I'm not an architect, but I think I would be very excited, you know, to compete if I would be one. Within this competition comes the question of how do we rebuild? Is that just rebuilding or is it restoration? How do we do that? With which materials, which style, which design? And so everything is open for the moment.
France shows again and again that it has a capacity to embrace really modern architecture. We think back to the Pompidou Centre, mm-hmm. which emerged out of a competition. The prize went to two very young architects, yes. Renzo Piano and Richard Rogers, and produced the absolutely stunning, mm-hmm. incredibly important, influential Pompidou Centre. And then in the 80s, you had the Grand Projet under President Mitterrand. Yes. Can you give us a sense of whether the French state might take a big risk and do something really 21st century?
It's a very good and very complicated question, and I'm not sure I can have a definitive answer. What I can say is that there have been in Paris projects. You mentioned Centre Pompidou or the Louvre with the, you know, the famous, the now the famous pyramid. All those projects were, especially the Centre Pompidou, was building a brand new building. So I think it was easier for architects or decision makers to decide to have an architecture that would be very avant-gardist or very new. In the case of Notre Dame, we're not starting from zero. There's, you know, there's a cathedral that is still there. So there's this heritage part that is very important. But in the same time, history has shown that Notre Dame has been adapted to its, you know, to its era. There've been, for example, in the 19th century, a major reconstruction led by Viollet-le-Duc, and that's when they, you know, they installed that spire, that very spire that burnt. But there's also a part that is also very important, is all the items that are hidden. For example, you know, the structure maintaining the roof. There's also a question, and there's also a debate starting in France on shall we rebuild, you know, the oak frame as it was, and it will require something like 1,300 oak trunks, or shall we use new materials? And, you know, keeping also in mind that, you know, Notre Dame Cathedral has a, you know, heritage building, there's a lot of rules, you know, governing the building itself and the preservation of architecture. But I'm convinced the outcome will be great and will be good for the cathedral to start a new era in the 21st century.
After the initial flurry of distress on the part of millions, then there starts to be a more complicated discussion around what's happened with Notre Dame. And one piece of that has been that the Yellow Vests in France have complained about this massive haul that's come in to rebuild a cathedral where nobody died. And they've argued, hang on a sec, you know, how about diverting some of this kind of money into social programs, into making people's lives better in France? How do you respond to that?
I think it's a one should compare things that are comparable. There's a social question in France and I think in Europe, and that is very true. And that's what the Yellow Vest protest showed, you know, a need for more maybe public money or more welfare for certain things. That's on the one hand. And on the other hand, it's true that Notre Dame fundraiser raised a lot of money in a very short period of time. And I think it's great for the cathedral and it's great for the building. And I think we can be very happy about this. But I don't think we, you know, things are, can be comparable. It's absolutely not the same thing. And, you know, I think all this money that was raised for Notre Dame will be used to rebuild and restore, which means that people will be paid and that will create, you know, economic activity. And so I think it will have something positive.
That was Christophe Lemoine, French Consul General in Los Angeles. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. As Christophe said, there will be a lot of debate about what comes next for Notre Dame. And some of that conversation is taking place here in LA. Just this weekend, I met up for breakfast with two French-born architects who also teach, Olivier Touraine at USC and Jean-Louis Cohen at NYU.
I was stunned because I found it extremely early in the process. The damage was not yet assessed. Almost no one had been inside the church. And already the French government making political communication out of it. So I think in Notre Dame is a complex piece of architecture. And it is as much a 19th century building as it is a 13th century building. And I would really like to see the work of Viollet le Duc, who not only built the spire, but also gave to the church its part of its look. The famous gargoyles on the roof are 19th century creation, based on a very imaginative, romantic view of the Middle Ages. And they've been very important in shaping the popular perception of that building. So I think preserving them is as important as preserving or restoring the stained glass windows of the 13th century. My concern is probably a premature and rather demagogic announcement.
Olivier Touraine, do you agree?
Yes and no. I was just more surprised by how fast it went in the process, and it seems to go almost in a military way. Actually, they name a former retired general to expedite the process. But in itself, I'm not surprised that they would organize a competition for, guess what, the spike and its kind of assertions of a certain architectural libido and this kind of phallic directions that actually was started with Viollet-le-Duc, because there was a very tiny one at some stage, if I may say, if you forgive myself, and that actually they were just the base for a much bigger one that Viollet-le-Duc literally erected.
So you're saying that Viollet-le-Duc, the 19th century architect who made the great big changes that you, Jean-Louis, have mentioned, the gargoyles, also extended upwards the spike. So there will be a discussion about whether or not to even restore the spike.
Several people in the preservationist establishment consider that the spike of the 19th century was an offense and would be happy to return to a sort of pre-Viollet-le-Duc state, which is completely unknown. We don't have any photographs. We have perhaps some views of the 17th century. So there has been, in similar cases, the temptation of de-restoring the building, return to its pre-romantic state. As Viollet-le-Duc said famously, a monument should not be rebuilt as it was, but that as it should have been. So he was aware of the ideal dimension, the demonstrative dimension of reconstruction more than restoration.
I think the quote really reinforced the fact that it's very likely that the between quotes, restored or between quotes, new cathedral probably shouldn't be exactly literally the same than what it was 10 days ago.
Olivier, you yourself do buildings that are very contemporary. You've also worked with a very well-known French architect, Jean Nouvel, who's absolutely in the vanguard of modern technologies and inventive design. So does it stir your juices, the idea of a design competition to rethink Notre Dame?
In fact, not personally, but I'm sure that a lot of people are getting way more over than excited. Actually, you just go online and look on Facebook what most of the colleagues or friends are posting, and there is a huge amount of time spent to do Photoshop collage already. Some are sarcastic and ironic. Some others are actually starting to be serious. That's the most terrifying thing, actually.
Terrifying because?
Because they truly believe that we could do anything. Then about the spike itself, I think it's like wild territories where the most insane and creative, between quotes, imaginations can be expressed. And we will see where it goes. But I think it's we are in totally unknown territories here.
Yes, there are many, many parties concerned. Of course, you have a state administration. Preservation Architects for Building belongs to the state, not to the city of Paris, not to a church. So we're dealing with a minister of culture who's not a great cultural figure. You have a president who casts himself as an intellectual. Then you have a preservation establishment, architects who are professionally involved in restoring the buildings. And you also have the forces of the construction industry. So we see, in fact, every group trying to use this to step on the mutilated body of the church to assert their preeminence, from people in power to people who are dreaming about putting their ego on top of a roof to people who want to promote their practical knowledge.
To be honest, that sounds a little like the Catholic Church itself has behaved over the centuries.
Yes, certainly. The Catholic Church has always been a broker of interest between various components of the aristocracy, the bourgeoisie, power. But it's not clearly not a moving force in this case. The Catholic Church is just the tenant of a building it doesn't own.
That's so fascinating. And I do wonder to what extent this global interest in what happens to Notre Dame is partly thanks to its imaging through Hollywood.
Yes, Notre Dame has been a sort of machine to produce images, literary images, historic images. Everyone, in a way, owns a piece, mental piece of that church through the readings, through the way it has been cast by the film versions of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. So everyone seems to have a right to a church. And the amount of money raised, this is another aspect, the amount of money raised in a matter of days is totally obscene when you compare it to what has been raised for social charities worldwide, or what has been raised, for instance, for a much more dramatic fire which took place 1 year ago in Rio, where the National
Rio de Janeiro.
Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, where the National Museum of Brazilian History burned with 2 million artifacts, which were the central memory of Brazil. So far, the director of that museum has been able to find $15 million, which compared to nearly the billion collected in 4 days for Notre Dame. So this measures in dollars or euros or whatever the emotional value of that building.
The other thing about that seems to have contributed strongly to Notre Dame's the potency of the imagery of Notre Dame around the world is the fact that France has not permitted the construction of tall towers in its historical centre. And so, therefore, Notre Dame has a presence that most churches and cathedrals in global cities do not have.
Yes, Paris has stopped building towers in its central part in the 70s. So the cathedral remains clearly, symbolically, the centre. The center of a city, the center of a country, point zero of all the roads radiating from Paris and going to the ends of the country is located on the square beneath a church. So, I mean, it is really a sort of omphalos mundi, a sort of belly button of the French world in many ways.
Which, of course, is fascinating, given how secular the French have become. So it's a symbol that is in a way hollow. I'm talking to you in Los Angeles. Are you finding that people you run into want to talk about Notre Dame? For some reason, it's just really got everybody going.
Yes, I'm receiving in various ways condolences for dear Angelino friends, as if I had lost a parent. So I find the emotion is extreme and is, again, related to the fact that there are two Notre Dames. There is the physical building made out of stone, wood, glass, lead, and brass, if you think of the organ. And there is also a building made of words, made of images, made of film stills, to which people relate much more than to the real one, perhaps.
That was Jean-Louis Cohen and Olivier Touraine. And this music that you're listening to is the Santa Monica High School Choir performing a concert at Notre Dame just 3 days before its great fire. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, we'll hear about the Jewish architects who brought Bauhaus ideals to the Holy Land. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Now, in the spirit of Passover, an Exodus story with a profound design impact. 100 years ago, the Bauhaus Art and Design School was founded in Weimar, Germany. The Nazis then shut it down in 1933. They saw the school's non-traditional design, its free-spirited attitude, and progressive politics as very threatening. Many of its faculty and students left Germany, taking the ideals of the school all over the world, including to Israel.
The Jewish population that migrates to Palestine is looking for a new expression. Right, for new architecture that would kind of express the reborn Jew, right, outside of Europe. And in a way, the kind of the ideas of the Bauhaus work perfectly with that.
Rafi Siegel is an architect and professor of architecture at MIT. We met at a recent housing conference in LA. Now, he happens to own a home in Princeton by a Bauhaus alumnus, Marcel Breuer. But he says he sees the school's most profound influence in his native country. Six Israeli architects studied in the Bauhaus School, and its legacy was absorbed by many others. You can find 4,000 modernist buildings in the so-called White City of Tel Aviv, asymmetric apartment towers with rounded balconies and flat roofs. But Siegel says these Bauhaus-inspired aesthetics were overlaid with the school's utopian social agenda in a founding Israeli experiment, the kibbutz.
So particularly two, Aryeh Sharon and Shmuel Mitzetchkin, which are Bauhaus graduates, they come to Israel, Aryeh Sharon returns, and they start working for the kibbutz movement to design this new settlement type, which is an agricultural community, which is a complete socialist society based on equality and mutual aid. And in a society that basically shares everything, there is no private property. So modernism lends itself perfectly, right? It's a new kind of way of living.
Kibbutzim were started at the dawn of the 20th century, but they jumped in population between the 1920s and the 1950s, when that Bauhaus spirit was in full flower.
The living areas, or the kind of the sleeping rooms, or small vernacular pitched roof, but then the common areas, the dining hall, the laundry, the collective kind of spaces, the gym, which was to serve the entire community, you know, between 200, sometimes 500 people, are these modern works of architecture, completely abstract by all kind of standards and principles of the modern aesthetics. Out there nowhere, sometimes in the desert, sometimes like surrounded by, you know, villages which have been around for centuries. So we tend to see this positive, perhaps naive, perhaps utopic idea of creating a new world, you know, a new image, a new architecture. But in the Israeli context, the kibbutz in its early days also acted as a form of erasure.
Of the people that lived there previously.
Right. The Palestinians. And it was on the forefront. It was, in a way, the outpost of the Zionist kind of movement to grab hold of land, right, and transform it, right, from the people who've been living there for centuries into a new vision of, you know, the land for the Jewish people. But it's through modernism that this transformation happens.
So in that sense, you're saying that it has had a mixed legacy.
Yes, but that's all put in proportion since the 1967 occupation and the settlement project, which is a suburban project of occupying the West Bank and the occupied territories. And the kibbutz is seen, of course, in a different light since eventually most of the kibbutz settlements are within the boundaries of the State of Israel.
Kibbutzim number in the hundreds in Israel. Over the years, some have dropped the socialist agricultural principles and have developed shopping malls and high-tech and military industries. Others have had to turn to state subsidies to survive, and some have been criticised for not living up to their collectivist worker ideals, instead employing Arab and non-kibbutz members to work in the farm or factory. But if the utopian aspect has waned, for Rafi Siegel, there are still some urban advantages.
Because historically, all of these communities were kind of organized top-down by a central managing body, which no longer exists. So now they're on their own. They want to preserve some of their values, the kind of equality and sharing values, but they also want private property. So this is a challenge, how to make that work. And this becomes a quite an interesting model to work with as an alternative to suburbia in general, as a better kind of way of living in low density.
Siegel is currently working with three kibbutzim. Hatzor in the south, Na'an, that's the first kibbutz that was established by Jews born in Israel, and it's the one with the highest population, and he's working on Hahatrim in northern Israel.
There is one project we're working on in a kibbutz in the north of the country that's kind of their dining hall is not in use anymore, and they kind of came to us and said, hey, what do we do with this building in the middle of the community, which is empty because we don't eat collectively. We eat, each one is, you know, has their own kitchen now in their house and eat and dine in their own home. What do we do with this enormous building? So we're rethinking that completely. And it's quite fascinating.
That was Rafi Siegel, architect and professor at MIT, talking about the legacy of the Bauhaus in Israel. I'm Frances Anderton, you're listening to DNA. Now, last week we brought you to Coachella, where the stages are decked out in the latest technologies. This week we're going to meet a photographer whose interest lies in a very different kind of performance space, a traditional opera house. And DNA's Avishai Artsy went to meet him.
It's gorgeous. Really big height, big stage, also a very deep stage.
Klaus Fromm stands in the middle of the stage at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. Hands on his hips, his blue shirt sleeves rolled up, he takes in his surroundings. Klaus turns to his analog 4x5-inch camera, made of wood, titanium, and leather.
I prefer to shoot on film because I don't like so much working at the computer and mending different images together, so you have the surprise when the film is developed. What comes out.
The camera rests atop a tripod. Fromm puts in a new slide. His photo assistant and life partner, Alexandra, looks at the stopwatch on her phone.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, stop.
Klaus's images are shot from the back of the stage, looking onto empty seats. There are no audience members or workers. The seats fill a square in the center of the photo. Around that square are the scaffolding, ropes, lights, and curtains that bring the productions to life. Klaus has been working on this series since 2010. He calls it the fourth wall, as in the invisible wall between the performer and the audience.
The idea of the fourth wall was invented in the 1890s by Jean Julien, and I choose it because people then start to think about theater, or what is a play.
Klaus is essentially pulling back the curtain on the artifice of theater. One gets to imagine how an actor feels on one of these grand stages, being stared at by hundreds of people looking to be entertained.
We call it Lampenfieber, when the lights go on and the fear and the anxiousness of the actors before the play, when they start playing.
Klaus is not the only member of his family interested in performance spaces. His son is Nils Fromm, famed experimental composer and musician who combines classical and electronic music. The night Klaus opened a photo show in Los Angeles, his son Nils was performing at the Walt Disney Concert Hall. I asked Klaus if father and son ever collaborate. Generally no, but he did provide photos for a book of his son's sheet music.
It's hand-coated black and white prints I made once in Portugal when we were on holiday. He was about 6 years old or 5 years old then.
Mostly, his son performs in large concert halls.
I don't photograph concert halls. I photograph theaters and opera houses, and this, I stick to that. But we share, for sure, the love for music and the experience of being on stage.
While in LA, Klaus also photographed the United Artists Theater, also known as the Theater at the Ace Hotel. But as he photographs the LA Opera stage, the backstage employees run around to help him. At one point, he looks up at the ceiling, at rows of pipes that raise and lower curtains or props or even the actors. He points his camera straight up.
He calls this part of the series cages because these are abstract spaces. You cannot guess where it is. Could be a science lab or some industrial plant or something like that. What is happening behind the scene, what the people don't see behind the decoration. It's all people working on a very tight schedule together, and everything is organized and planned.
He then asks the backstage crew members to lower some of the pipes and attach them to three orange ladders. They then raise them halfway to the ceiling. The ladders dangle midair at odd angles. Steve Williams is the production electrician for LA Opera Company.
Very interesting. This guy has a wild imagination. It's really cool.
Jeff Kleeman is LA Opera's technical director.
These images make us feel very much at home. And I think it reveals the magnitude and the scale of the and the complexity of the operation.
Klaus Fromm packs up his camera and heads for the exit. But then he spots a harpsichord in the corner. He can't help himself. It's his chance to perform on this stage. For DNA, I'm Avishai Artsy.
Klaus Fromm's series, The Fourth Wall, is on view at Gallery 12 through Saturday. You can see images from the series at kcrw.com/DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. You've been listening to DNA. Avishai Artsy produced and edited this program with a final mix by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajian. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.